today is Robert Dodd, Commonwealth Virginia. Hargett or Hargett?
Hargett.
Hargett, thank you, sir. Mr. Hargett, for the appellant, and Ms. Boren for Commonwealth. And would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal, sir?
I would like 3 minutes, if I may.
3 minutes, sure.
All right. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is David Hargett, and represent Mr. Dodd on the appeal of his convictions. This is one of those situations where the witness's testimony was so prejudicial that the bell cannot be unrung. As a matter of fact, as I've argued,
let's deal with whether this is a timely objection first. You were trial counsel, yeah.
That's correct. I'm the public counsel.
You were not even had I not looked at the record, because I think you know better. So I know you know better. But the question was asked, and the question was, at some point did the relationship between the two of you all deteriorate? Answer, yeah. Stop right there. So far, I think we can probably agree there's nothing wrong with the question and nothing wrong with that answer so far. The problem comes when the witness then goes on and talks about what she suspected. There's no objection. In fact, if I'm counting correctly, there's about 9 more questions and still no objection.
Well, I counted as 2, Your Honor, so we might have a difference of opinion there. Prosecutor kept saying, okay, that's not a question.
Well, that's true.
So if you look, there is one question on page 68 of the appendix, and that just simply says, after you left, did Kyle ever move into the house? And then there's a question on page 69, what do you mean by that? But basically, follow-up question.
Well, the objection to this made is a relevancy objection. Not a speculation objection, it's based on relevance, which is still objectionable, and it probably is irrelevant. But I guess my point is, are you relying on no cautionary instruction was even requested. I mean, the mistrial was ultimately requested. But in terms of how we get to your unringing the bell or whether we can or can't, I mean, it seems we have to deal with whether or not we even got a preserved objection here.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would say a couple of things to that. I did follow a reply brief addressing that specifically. And one of the things I said is that this has never been brought up before. This is the first time this issue has been raised. And I think that that is problematic, particularly when you look at what the trial court did and what happened. So what you and so whether it's appropriate for the Commonwealth to even bring that argument up now, I think is something that this court can and should address initially. And I've actually cited a case that talks about, since this argument hadn't been raised, different context, but the same kind of idea, that since this argument had not been raised before, we're not going to allow the Commonwealth to raise it. Now, certainly the prosecution at the time of the argument, the jury was taken out of the room, obviously, and there was an extensive argument about the admissibility of this, and the judge was actually quite angry that these statements were made. And so if you look at it in that context, what's most important about the timeliness of the objection is not the motion for the mistrial, it's the cautionary instruction. Because the court has to be able to take remedial measures, in order to correct a problem if one did occur. And clearly, one did occur. The judge had no problem ruling that one occurred. He even went so far as to say, if this happens again, we're going home. Meaning, if she throws in one more comment, even close to this, this is a mistrial every day. And so he's very clear about that. So what ends up happening is the court has the opportunity and takes the opportunity to issue the cautionary instruction. So quite frankly, once that happens, and that is clearly timely, I mean, the judge, again, this is something that wasn't argued at trial, which is also problematic for me, to have to then defend something that wasn't even mentioned. But nevertheless, the judge had no problem with the timeliness. The prosecution had no problem with the timeliness. The jury was instructed not to consider that testimony. So what could possibly be untimely? The motion for the mistrial isn't untimely at that point. It can't be. For instance, I will refer to later on.
Maybe let me be clear, Mr. Hargett, because I think maybe your point is well taken, but I think in context my concern, and maybe I'm not expressing it very well, is it seems to me the point at which the objection is made is important only from the standpoint of whether or not a cautionary instruction is sufficient. Obviously, more time that passes, you know, in this case, the jury is out, and it's really unclear how much time has passed during this recess. But in any event, at the point in time the cautionary instruction is, in fact, it is ultimately given, there's been a passage of some appreciable degree of time, it seems to me. At least that seems to be implicit from the record. And I hear you arguing that the cautionary instruction is insufficient and the mistrial should have been granted. But had the cautionary instruction been given earlier because an objection was made earlier, maybe the cautionary instruction would not have been so problematic under your analysis. So, I mean, I think that's the context in which I'm still not sure I'm making myself very clearly a puzzled expression on this, so I apologize for that.
No, well, the problem with that is that there's nothing wrong with the cautionary instruction per se. There's nothing wrong with the timeliness.
I would presume the juries follow those instructions.
Understandably. And if there's nothing wrong with it, and even trial counsel says, look, I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with it. It can't be undone. The seed has been planted, and therefore there's nothing that you can do or say, judge, to this jury, no matter how you phrase that cautionary instruction. And you know from having done this for quite some time that these are very difficult concepts. You can't come out and say, well, I want to remind everybody that this witness said X, Y, and Z, and you not to consider it, because now you're putting it back in front of them again. So you have to be very cautious.
Well, I also know that it's a tactical decision by a lawyer to whether you even ask for a cautionary instruction, because it's very much like saying, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, please don't look at that elephant standing in the back of the room right there. You know, it has the opposite effect from the one intended.
Exactly. So, but again, when we talk about the timeliness of it, there was an opportunity for the judge to correct it. Two questions were asked different. I mean, so the time factor, if you want to talk about the quantity of time, is not significant. There's no significant additional information that's put out there. They're basically just talking about, well, what, did he move into the house or not? So what? Maybe that takes 20 seconds. I don't know. How could that possibly be a problem if nobody has a problem with it at trial? The judge instructs the jury not to consider that testimony without actually calling attention to it. I mean, clearly he's talking about suspicions. And I've cited the case law that says, you know, we need to look at this on a case-by-case basis. This is a situation, and I'll refer the court to pages 488 and 489. I did not mention this in the briefs previously, but I think it's important, of the appendix, 488 and 489. This is the third time this case had been tried. This witness had testified previously, obviously. This is something that completely came out of the blue, and I did mention that in my reply. This is not something that was expected at all, and it's kind of like one of those what did she just say moments. How could somebody possibly throw in this slanderous statement and expect that it's perfectly fine on the third trial that this case has been going? This is the third time this has happened, this trial anyway, because they couldn't reach a verdict the first two times. So if you look at it in the context, defense counsel at least has a reason for going, what did she just say? Probably looked to co-counsel and said that. I imagine that's exactly what happened. But nevertheless, made the objection. The jury's taken out. It's argued. And he says, look, you can't unring the bell. Cautionary instruction, fine, but you can't unring the bell. What difference does it make? If he comes back at the very end of the case and says, I want, judge, you to reconsider the ruling.
In terms of unringing the bell, you know, we have a witness who testifies unsolicited about her suspicions of having an inappropriate relationship with a neighborhood boy. But we also have evidence in the record that from the defense, in fact, and I realize you were trial counsel, two unrelated adult men were living in the home. So I guess the question would be how prejudicial is that inappropriately admitted testimony, given that it's, you know, a conclusion that a fact finder could reasonably draw from the evidence the defense presented in this case.
If we're off the timeliness issue and now to the merits of the case, I think that's why I pointed out in the brief what happened at jury selection, because this is the first witness who testifies at this trial before this jury anyway. And so what is important to know is that the jury is told what this case is, who it involves, and they're asked a whole bunch of questions about, can you believe a witness even if there's no other corroborating evidence? There's no DNA. There's no any of this other stuff. Is it okay? You know, that's how the jury was selected. They're told what the charges are. They're told that he's on trial for being a child molester. She doesn't just testify about a suspicion. If you read the statement, it is much more damning than that. What she actually says is, I've had a suspicion for a long time. So this is not some fleeting or momentary suspicion. This is something that she's had a long time, that he had an inappropriate relationship with a neighborhood boy. Not a young person, not anything, a boy. That clearly conveys a young individual. And then to say, not only was it suspicion, and those suspicions were confirmed when he moved him into the home. So you have the triple whammy, if you will, a suspicion about having an inappropriate relationship with a neighborhood boy, I'd say can't be anything other than an inappropriate sexual relationship with a little boy, a neighborhood boy. I mean, what else would it be?
Counsel, let me ask this. When you talk about prejudice to your client's result of that, wasn't there some unobjective testimony that was introduced with regard to the defendant's actions with regard to another young man besides the alleged victim in this case, about measuring his penis?
Well, and there was some testimony about that, sure. Yeah. There was.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, but if you look at it, this is not, I phrase it as the Commonwealth's evidence was weak. And I think that that's clear from the fact that they're missing a lot of information that you would normally expect to have. And if you don't agree with that, I think that the court can at least agree that it's not overwhelming evidence. We don't have a confession. We don't have any type of DNA. We don't have anything else. The mere fact that at some point, long time ago, there was this measuring of penises to see who won, you know, you could chalk that up as the guys being guys, quite frankly.
Couldn't you say that in combination with what Judge Humphreys is indicating about the other individual testifying with the neighborhood boy who's now living with your client, as well as what she's indicating about the measuring of the penises, that there would be no prejudice? I mean, are there parts of the record that you could point to that would indicate that there was prejudice? Or not? And understanding there's sort of the elephant in the room or the bell that you can't unring, what can you point to in the record that would establish that?
Well, I don't understand the court's question, because you're necessarily assuming that the neighborhood boy that she refers to and never identifies somehow has something else to do with this case. And I don't think that it does.
I'm only saying that there was testimony from one of the defense witnesses that a neighborhood boy was living in the house with your client.
I don't think that that's what the testimony was. Not a neighborhood boy, and it certainly wasn't linked back to this statement.
Let me rephrase the wording. She didn't say... The witness for the defense didn't say, boy, that a neighborhood man had moved in with your client. And one of the questions that Judge O'Brien was asking was about the prejudice and the measuring of penises. I'm saying, if you sort of aggregate the two, you've got certain factors that the jury can consider. So what I'm asking is, if you're looking just at the other parts of the record, where would the prejudice be?
The prejudice is that if the jury for one second thinks that he's a child molester based on that inappropriate testimony, that they cannot unthink that. That's the prejudice, and there's nothing more prejudicial than that. And I think I've pointed to that.
Okay. You're going to be into your rebuttal. We had a question right at the beginning of your rebuttal, so we'll put your rebuttal back to 3 minutes. But if you want to wait and continue going, you may, or we'll give you 3 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will save my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellee, the Commonwealth of Virginia. The first thing I'd like to say is you really can't have it both ways. And that is what a lot of counsel's argument is asking for this court to have it both ways. And by that, I mean, he says, well, there was this terrible delay in objection giving the instruction, and that delay prejudiced my client. But that delay was based on the defense's failure to make a timely motion for a mistrial, which under Yates is required to be made when the words are spoken. It doesn't matter how many questions are asked. The determinative factor is when the words are spoken. And the reason for that is so that the judge can give a timely instruction and doesn't have to bring it up later. So that's attributable to him. Not him exactly, but counsel at trial. His failure to make a timely objection, according to Yates and its requirements, that you make the objection and a motion for a mistrial when the words are spoken. So here, that motion for a mistrial was not timely made, and Yates controls. And there's another case that, in fact, Mr. Hargett and I had together, Clatterbaugh. It was an unpublished decision, but it was the same thing. I have a motion. many questions passed, and only later does he say, I have a motion for a mistrial. Those motions were also not timely made. And then when we talk about the merits in this case, there was no manifest prejudice here. In this case, first of all, a curative instruction was given in this case, and juries are presumed to follow the instructions. In addition, it was an unresponsive remark, meaning that the prosecutor didn't elicit this question, didn't seek to introduce inappropriate evidence, as in fact he noted there had been prior trials and nothing like this had happened before. She didn't ask a question that would elicit such a response. It was just a gratuitous response. So the Commonwealth shouldn't be punished for this witness just making an improper, unsolicited response unless it is incurable, unless it is fits the very high threshold required for mistrial, which it is not in this case. In addition, the defense introduced evidence himself of a young man who was, I believe, 19 years old, who was living in the house, and in fact introduced that evidence to show that the victim in this case was making up this story because he was jealous. That was their theory, that he was jealous of the relationship that the defendant had with this young man, Paul, that he moved into the house. That was the argument that was made. Kayla said, oh, he was jealous. There was all of this suggestion that somehow that was why he came up with the story of molestation. Of course, that doesn't wash because he first reported this molestation to his friend in 2006, and the young man didn't even move in 2011 until 2011. But nonetheless, that was an attempt to make that argument that, in fact, there was a jealousy issue, and so that was injected by the defense in this case. When he says, well, that's not the same thing, she said, a young boy moved into the house, there was no other evidence that there was anybody else living in the house other than some other girls and other children who were living in the house, but the young boy was Paul, and it was very adequately explained that that was a young man who had apparently just turned the age of 18 or 19 years old. So she could have certainly been referring to Paul when she said a young boy, and it was a reasonable inference that the jury could have made, rendering any prejudice in this case much less. And finally, I would take issue with his characterization of this evidence in this case as weak. Although this was the victim's testimony primarily in this case, it was very powerful testimony and involved corroborative circumstances such as his identifying particular marks on the defendant's penis, unusual physical characteristics that one would not have a reason to know about a stepfather unless something inappropriate had gone on. And even where that was on the penis. Not just that he had an abnormality, but was able to say what that abnormality was and where it was. In addition, it was corroborated by the testimony of another child who said that his experience of measuring penises with the defendant in this case, far from being just guys being guys, was creepy and weird. That was his characterization of what had happened to him in the victim's presence with the defendant in this case. And finally, the victim in this case testified that he loved his father, and he was 29 years old. This isn't a child who's being led around by some mother to make up testimony. He had had a long time to think about what had happened to him and was able to articulate it very carefully, including a lot of details which I think are very powerful, including that it was able to only make sense of what happened to him and the manipulation that was used upon him by testifying about some icy hot that the defendant apparently in an effort to abuse him and not be discovered was using to try to turn this into some sort of medical issue. And he was only able as an adult to realize that the defendant had used this horrible manipulation on him as a child in order to justify his fondling and other abuse. So there was powerful evidence in this case. There was corroborative evidence in this case. And the testimony that was given was not prejudicial because it was explained by defense evidence. And when I say you can't have it both ways, the defense didn't have to put on evidence that a young man was living in the house and that there was jealousy. They chose to put on that evidence. They chose to put on that evidence after they had made a motion for a mistrial. If they wanted to leave it as there's this young child that he somehow moved into the house and make an argument, if it was such a big deal that it required a mistrial, they could have left it there. But instead they chose to put on evidence that this young man had moved into the house and that all of this was the result of jealousy. And having done that, they can't have it both ways. And so I would urge you to affirm the conviction in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Brown.
First and foremost, I never said that the delay was prejudicial. I never argued that. I said it was unfortunate that there was another matter I had to take up. So the first thing that counsel said is simply not the case. The reference to Clattervaugh is grossly misplaced, and it's not really part of this record. It hasn't been cited. So, but I will tell, since it was brought up, that was a situation where the motion for mistrial wasn't made until it was about an improper closing argument. The judge said, we'll take that up later. Defense counsel said, okay. They took it up later. The court ruled that you can't do that. You can't correct something after the jury's already been sent to go deliberate. Of course not. Look at Burns and look at Angel. I've cited both of those in my brief, and they're especially the reply brief, and those talk about case-by-case basis and why it might be appropriate or better to do it the moment that it happens. If it's it can be a situation where if it's able to be addressed. This is not a situation where the witness had left the stand and then there was additional argument. I mean, that's not the case. This was very contemporaneously done. The clean hands of the Commonwealth, I tend to disagree. They didn't expect this answer. They certainly defended it at the motion for a mistrial. They said, well, we're just talking about her perception. We're not really talking about her facts. Well, that's the defense. They didn't ever said, we didn't know this was coming. This was a surprise to us. This is clearly the estranged spouse and now ex-wife who is very angry at this individual, slandering him. Jealous of a relationship? Read the record. That's not what the testimony was. It was that the complaining witness was jealous that the other person moved into the house. Keep in mind, this is a house where his sisters lived. His sisters got to stay in the house. The individual didn't. That was one of the motives to fabricate. And not only that, but the sisters also testified that he lies to get his way, that he is deceitful and cannot be believed. These are his sisters who testified to that. That was the defense evidence in this case. So you certainly can't say that he's so believable because he knows things. He's almost 30 years old by the time this case goes to trial. Of course he knows things about his father or his stepfather. Of course, and there's testimony about him seeing him getting out of the shower and so forth. You live with somebody long enough, you're going to know things. So I think that when you boil this case down to it, if the jury understood that we're talking about not only suspicion but confirmation of inappropriate sexual relations with a young person in a neighborhood that you can't tie to anybody else in this case, so that's completely absurd. But if you look at it like that, there's no way this jury could then completely remove it from their minds when he's on trial for being a child molester. There's nothing more damaging than that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down and do